Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast, and I'm really excited about the conversation that I'm going to have today with my guest. Her name is Dr. Jessie Mahoney, and she's given me the okay to call her Jessie. So Jessie, I want to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation because a lot of the conversations I have on the podcast are about the challenges couples have in their neurodiverse relationships. And I do try to add a lot of strength-based information. But we're going to talk not only about the amazing work you do, but we're going to talk about the success of your neurodiverse relationships. So I'd love if we could start by having you share a little bit about what you do and maybe a little introduction to your neurodiverse relationship.
Happy to. So I am actually a pediatrician. I always say by training, which means that I trained and practiced in pediatrics for 20 plus years. And I have pivoted more recently, and in large part because of my neurodiverse relationship, to coaching and mindfulness. And I run a business now called Pause and Presence, where I do a lot of coaching for 99% of the people I work with are women. And many of them are in neurodiverse relationships. So that's not specifically my niche, but because I'm very open about my own, people tend to gravitate towards me. And I work primarily with people who are physicians or, as I would say, high achievers who are in that same sort of go, go, go mindset. And many of us, it turns out, have chosen to marry people who are neurodiverse for a lot of actually clear reasons. And there are a lot of reasons why that's actually a fit. And so I did want to come today, and I know that when I talked to you about coming on the podcast, to provide some hope. And I think that my purpose in that is that when we figured out that my husband was neurodiverse, and I'll tell a little bit more about that story, I searched everywhere and everywhere and didn't find a whole lot of hope. I found a lot of complaining and a lot of the negatives and why it doesn't work, which I was quite familiar with. Sure. And I was really looking for resources and things that did work. And so I'm hoping today to at least share those, being very clear that, of course, there's always challenges and always conflict. And I would say there is actually in every relationship. But I have found things that do really help us. And we have seen just a very significant change with the knowledge of the neurodiversity and then very specific intentional changes, which I will say at the outset are 99% my changes. When I change, my husband has changed. But without that, you know, I think I went into it, well, if I do X, you should do Y. And my experience working in neurodiverse relationships is that that actually is not a super effective strategy.
Right.
And the beautiful thing about changing yourself is that that's in your control. And that's something that in the coaching world, we talk about a lot, you know, focus on what's in your control. And when you work on yourself, and you and I will talk about some of those things, the changes I made, that actually can cause tremendous shift. So a little bit about my own neurodiverse relationship. My husband and I actually met in high school when he was 14 and I was 15. And we have pretty much been together since. And, you know, I didn't know about his neurodiversity until probably, I would say, 22 years into our marriage and maybe 30 years into our relationship. But now that I know about it, it actually kind of makes sense how it all evolved. But we stayed together pretty much the whole time. And as he says, which I think is pretty, gets at the neurodiversity, he liked me, thought it was a good thing, latched on, and he's loyal and has never, like, that's just what he decided. And that's how, you know, he was going to live his life.
Right.
And I think that's actually fairly typical. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a long distance relationship in college, and we're not exactly the same age, so a little bit longer. And I actually will say that for our relationship probably was really, really helpful. There's a lot communicated, I've discovered recently, in all these old letters that make it painfully obvious that we're a neurodiverse couple, though we didn't know that. But I think it was a really nice way to communicate. There was space and there was intentionality, which, you know, in those days there weren't cell phones or texting, so you couldn't have a lot of that same reactivity. Right. And I think it really helped in building some of our strengths. And so when we figured out my husband was neurodiverse, as I mentioned, was maybe about 22 years into our marriage. We had three children. And I was a full-time practicing doctor, and my husband was a lawyer. And he was at that time struggling with really significant depression, working in a place that wasn't great for a neurodiverse person. He worked in a law firm that used to be little that was bought out by a big firm, and it just wasn't a good fit for someone like him. And so he kind of spiraled down into depression. And it was in that point that I really started researching things. And as a pediatrician, I actually diagnose a lot of kids with autism Sure. and ADD and neurodiversity. And I can't tell you why, but one day it just occurred to me. And I thought, oh my gosh, this explains everything. And I thought I was brilliant. And I went and explained to my husband. I used the words first. He didn't even know the words because, you know, we're in our 50s. And at when we were growing up, nobody used these words. And so he Right. said, well, what is that? And I gave him the definition. He said, oh, that's me. and it was just like he had, and I know that's not true for everyone, but it was just mm-hmm. very clear and very much a fact that of sort of the way it was. And I will say that I probably had some grief thinking, huh, now I'm going to have to figure this out. But really, you know, I'm a force, and I think many women in these relationships are. I was like, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to understand it. And I read and read and read and did all kinds of things to try to figure it out, not necessarily to try to change him. I really went on a mission to understand everything I could. Mm-hmm. I also, at that time, and it was really not to manage neurodiversity, but to help with his depression, we had three close to teenagers. Our kids are a bit spaced apart, but, and I had a busy pediatric practice and several leadership roles, and I couldn't hold it all together and do all this at the same time. And so I went back to, I say, mindfulness and yoga. And mm-hmm. what I found there were a lot of inner solutions for myself. And in fact, I found it so helpful that I ultimately became a yoga teacher. And I won't say ultimately, like within a year, I thought I need to learn all these tools because they're changing me and they're changing my home life. They're changing my career experience. And I also reached out and hired a coach. And I will say she was not a relationship coach or a neurodiversity coach. I actually hired a coach to help me with my career slash things just weren't, there was too much going on. And I think I didn't have a great understanding of it. But the work that I did in coaching was tremendously helpful for my relationship when I sort of took it out of that context and applied it on my own. So then I actually went and got trained as a coach. One, because I wanted to help physicians. One of my roles in my big healthcare organization was wellness for physicians and helping people navigate the challenges of practicing in medicine, which are not all that different than the challenges of practice or living in a neurodiverse relationship. Lots out of your control and that can't be changed. Sure. And how do you navigate it and stay buoyant or afloat? So I decided that I wanted to become a coach so that I understood it and I could figure out why it had helped me so much and could I share it with my colleagues. And I will say, ultimately, I actually left my practice 4 years ago and 4.5 now, and have been coaching full time and teaching people mindfulness and helping them blend those two because it has been just such a big change in my life. And I think getting back to this sort of beginning loop of it's really about changing ourselves and choosing to change ourselves. We always want our partner to change, but we really have to start with ourselves and our own expectations and the way that we show up for the relationship. And when we do that, magical yes. things start to happen. I always say, especially in neurodiversity, you don't know what they'll be and they're out of your control. So you're not actually saying I'm going to do this and he's going to do that, but it really does create a big change when you change yourself. And I think the other revelation that I think is helpful at the outset of our conversation is that I realized that if I came in thinking he should change how I wanted him to, which is funny because now I realize that would be absolutely impossible, that I would have to change the way he wanted me to, which would also be impossible. And so therefore that sort of way of thinking about the relationship was going to be absolutely useless to us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a great point. And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. So many of us think that if our partner changes in these ways, and we can list 100 of them, then everything will be copacetic and we'll be happy and they'll be happy. And that's just not true. Yeah. And I love what you know, shared about your journey and that you decided to work on yourself, become a coach, become a yoga practitioner, and that you're helping, you know, physicians and others who are in really stressful jobs. And if they're in, you know, a relationship with somebody they love and that person or they happen to be neurodivergent, there might be other stresses that they didn't understand, not knowing that they or their partner was is neurodivergent. So I know one of the things that has helped me tremendously, and I know you do a lot of work in this area, is helping to retrain our nervous system. And I can't tell you how many times when I talk about this in the couple support groups that I facilitate, that it's like for oftentimes for both partners, it's like a deer in headlights. And I'll tell you, there's two reasons why. One, the person who is more emotional thinks that it's okay to be more emotional and wants their partner to be more emotional, but they don't understand that being dysregulated and emotional causes challenges for themselves and their partner. And the partner who is not maybe familiar with their emotions at the level that their non-autistic partner is, or they may have alexithymia, they're kind of not aware of how they could regulate or retrain their nervous system. So I'd love if you could share maybe a little bit about your journey and some of the work you do with others, because I know this is critical and has been for me too.
Well, yeah. And I just want to clarify, right? We say we are neurodiverse and yet we all have human nervous systems. And so our, you know, our nervous systems maybe work differently, but we also have trapped in our nervous systems all kinds of other things like trauma and different types of energy. And so we actually have two kinds of nervous systems. We have our parasympathetic nervous system, which in lay terms is like rest and digest or the calm one. And then your sympathetic nervous system, which is the reactive run from the tiger one in layman's terms. But most of us in the world today live in our sympathetic nervous system. And I would say actually both partners in a neurodiverse marriage probably live there because of when you don't know that you're in it and you're not being intentional. Because you use the word dysregulated, and I would just say like feel uncomfortable and are feeling confused or bewildered is a word I use a lot. I'm bewildered. And that just means I, you know, it's not something that I can understand. And so the work that we can do, and again, your partner can do it if they want. I've actually discovered that my partner is much more mindful than I ever was naturally. He just operates at a, well, and I've heard you say this, a much more slow pace than I do, even as a lawyer, just slow and thoughtful. And it used to drive me crazy. And now I just appreciate that at least, I mean, he will get reactive if you keep poking. For sure, I know how to do that, but not at baseline. But for me, as the neurotypical partner, understanding how to be mindful and how to work on my nervous system so that I was less reactive and that I wasn't in this chronic state of fight or flight, or we would call it adrenal depletion. Because when you're depleted and you're in fight or flight, we just react. We're not responding intentionally. We're not pausing. That's part of my pause and presence, right? You have to have the pause. Otherwise, you're not showing up intentionally. And in a neurodiverse situation, you have to pause and remember that your nervous systems work differently and the way your brains work differently. And so it's training your nervous system. And there's so many ways to do that. I think many people think they have to do things like mindfulness-based stress reduction and meditate for 45 minutes a day. And if you want, you can.
Sure.
But you can also use just apps and do them for 5 minutes. You can learn different breathing practices. I do a lot of breathing, pause and breathe and before I respond. And that makes all the difference in the world. And so figuring out what works for you, and I will say that's probably why I became a yoga teacher, because it's helped me to literally change my physiologic level of reactivity. I'm much less reactive. I have more capacity to pause and breathe. And that pause can be like a nanosecond. It just gets you out of that immediate physiologic dysregulation, reactivity. And for so many of us, our nervous systems are not healthy in the world today, no matter what kind of relationship you're in. And so this work can be really powerful. And it doesn't have to be hard. So some people do restorative yoga is one of the things that I think I'm thinking in this moment about what would help people in neurodiverse relationships. So that's not hot yoga or power yoga. That is literally restoring your nervous system. It's designed to do that. And that could be in child's pose or feet up the wall. You have your pose that you do and you can do it for 5 minutes, you know, each night, or can make a huge difference long-term. So again, you don't have to stand on your head to get the benefit of it or have an intense practice. Any little bit you do, even, you know, 5% change makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I so agree with all of that. And I changed my practice. For me, I don't do yoga. I'm sure my body could eventually get there, but it's not my thing. I go to the gym. And, you know, I'm not doing heavy duty workouts. But every time that I've felt myself really dysregulated, I get in the car, I go to the gym, I spend an hour to an hour and a half there. And I kind of force myself to do that. I leave the gym on such a high, but also relax at the same time. So I always say to the couples and the individuals that come to my support groups, find your kind of peaceful, happy place. You know, it may be a walk around your house. It may be turning on music and dancing. And so we all have different ways that we can kind of get out of that fight or flight kind of mindset. But if we don't learn this stuff, Jesse, then we're constantly in that state of reacting, right? And it's not healthy for you and it's not healthy for your partner, but you have to have this awareness. So retraining our nervous systems is so, so helpful. But also I know we all kind of can stay stuck sometimes in the stories we tell ourselves or the history that we keep repeating. So our thoughts and our stories really impact us too if we let them. So I know that's another area where you're helping and coaching people. So can you share a little bit about stories and how they can affect us and our relationships?
Absolutely. And I think the first thing that comes to mind to share about that is that most of us don't even realize they're stories. We think they're facts. This happened, but it's our interpretation of what happened. And I think in neurodiverse relationships, there's an awful lot of misinterpretation. And so the stories are even less true. And you and I were talking also that we and you and your partner often have very different stories of the exact same situation when you are in a neurodiverse relationship. And so realizing that this concept of stories is really, really helpful. And so we can use stories to tell ourselves good stories, focusing on what's good about being in a neurodiverse relationship or what's good about your partner and remembering the things that you liked. I think we often talk about how they're not that person, but there is that person still there. Most of us fell in love with someone because they're a good person. And it's remembering those things that you like or appreciate or that are even better about a neurodiverse relationship. I think the other thing is to connect with how you're the same. We spend so much time focusing on how we're different. And I would say, well, we both want happy and healthy children. We both want to have a relationship that's calm and loving and peaceful and not full of conflict, right? So if you can tap into that, that can be a really helpful way to think about it. And then I think for me, one of the biggest things was to realize that this relationship was never going to be the same as someone else's not neurodiverse relationship. And so then you get rid of all the stories about why it should be something different and really focusing on just what it is and how you would like to feel. And it's going to look different. And so if we tell ourselves stories that this is what a relationship looks like and this is what someone who loves you is supposed to do, you will perpetually be unhappy. I have a story I actually love, which came up a long time into our relationship. My husband makes really good coffee. He likes making coffee. And he likes to get up and drink his coffee by himself. And he likes to bring me coffee, really nice coffee. At different times, he'll even make like it can could be a special thing. Anyway, I used to say, "Well, you haven't done anything, and you haven't told me you love me, and you haven't done." He would say, "What do you mean? I brought you coffee." And so I then now refer to my cup of coffee as a cup of love. Like I literally look at it and just rename it that. That's a story, but that's a story that makes me feel better and helps us connect rather than the story that, love is not a cup of coffee. And so I think you can use the stories both ways. They can cause you a lot of pain and they can build connection and make things better.
I absolutely agree. And, part of that is reframing. I mean, in my marriage that was 30 years and we were together for 32, I would reframe things often in the negative. And when I found out that we were a neurodiverse couple in our 29th year of marriage, oh my gosh, the reframing that I went through in understanding why there were so many negatives between us. And then I turned them into more positive stories because I understood. And I do think that is a challenge. And I don't know if you experience this with the folks that you're working with or you're coaching. I think letting go and grieving for the things that have happened before that were stories you told yourself about, not being valued, not being appreciated, not being loved, no matter what your neurotype is in the relationship. And then when you understand how differently your brains are wired, if you reframe those stories and that history you have together through a different lens, you can begin to heal and forgive and grow together if you choose to.
Yeah.
And
Takes
thoughts
so
on
much
that?
compassion to also realize, I think, and I've heard you say this many times, right? That we caused, I'm not going to say it quite right, but we caused a lot of inadvertent harm, not knowing it, and nobody intended to. So to me, that invites just a tremendous amount of, Kristen Neff calls it tender self-compassion. And it's really self-compassion as well as compassion for the other person. But I think it has to, doesn't have to be, but you want to approach it that way. Because otherwise being mad at yourself doesn't help. Being mad at them doesn't help. And really that's the path forward. The other interesting thing, I know we were talking about nervous system retraining, but a fight or flight nervous system releases all kinds of cortisol, which feels terrible. And self-compassion and a healthy story releases neurochemicals or neuromodulators like oxytocin and dopamine that feel good. And so they're actually sort of filling your cup and filling your physiologic reservoir and helping that nervous system continue to be healthy and non-reactive.
And that's so important. And I love what you said about the cup of coffee from your husband being a cup of love, because and I've shared this a few times on the podcast, my ex would bring me my favorite chocolate bar, which is Snickers. And I knew that every time he brought that chocolate bar that he was trying to say something. But I think I was so stuck in the negative of what had happened, the story I was telling me myself about what preceded the Snickers bar, that I couldn't get beyond that and couldn't appreciate that what he was saying was, I'm sorry, or I didn't understand what you needed in that moment. I love you. I care about you. Here's your most favorite chocolate bar in the world. And oftentimes he would get me, I don't even know if they still make them, like the king size ones that are like three bars in one, right? And so, if
I
you
love
can
that.
go back and look at your relationship with the person that you love through a very different lens. You can, I do believe. I mean, I don't hold any grudges or anything like that, but I have done tremendous healing because I look at the stories I told myself about my ex and about our marriage through a now very compassionate and loving lens. But I know it can be really hard for folks because, you know, there may be abuse, whether it's emotional or financial or physical. We're not talking about that. We're talking about where you really didn't understand each other. And so let's,
One of the
yeah, go
most
ahead.
powerful stories, I just want to, story phrases that I use is that he's doing the best he can and I'm doing the best I can.
Yes.
And sometimes it doesn't look very good
Yeah.
and sometimes it's great. But I think a lot of people, you know, we're judging the outcome, but we're not really judging the effort. And I have actually come now to ask, like, is that the best you can do? And then he'll say yes, and I'll be like, okay, like I might be disappointed, but then I'm getting that it's not that he's not trying. Like this is really the best he's got. And I wanted to piggyback on your idea that it's not easy. It might sound easy, and you and I are people who've done a lot of work on it. And even then, it's not easy. It takes effort and commitment and a decision that you're going to keep working at it. And that sometimes it's not, I mean, you do have to recognize if there are places where it's not healthy. And that I often say in coaching that the grass is greener where you water it, meaning water your relationship. But if you're in a toxic or abusive relationship, and no matter how much you water it, that's like it's getting Roundup poured on it. It just doesn't work.
Right,
And you should
right.
be somewhere else. So I don't think either of us are saying that, but I
No.
do think it's important to change the way you think. And then if you need to make a change, you need to make a change, unless you're unsafe, in which case change already.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the other things that I hear often is, you know, my partner isn't willing to listen, my partner isn't willing to change, my partner isn't willing to do any of the work. And I think sometimes, just like you said with the cup of coffee, if we change the lens that we're looking at our partner through, and instead of expecting them to respond the way we would, or communicate the way we would, or be emotionally available the way we are, and instead looked at the positive attributes that they bring to the relationship, and they may be very different, that can be so helpful, that reframing. But also, I think it's important for us to think about, you know, what are our non-negotiables? What are the things, the top things that we need in a romantic relationship? Because sometimes our partners, you know, may grow in different directions, or we may, and we may no longer be compatible. But you've kind of figured this out, right? So, or
Well,
you're
and I
figuring
think
it out every day,
I'm figuring
right?
it out
And
every day. But I
right.
also think sometimes we have this idea of what a romantic relationship is supposed to be.
Oh yeah,
And
Disney.
that's not actually, I mean, I see so many people that get divorced and get divorced again, not even in a neurodiverse relationship, but they do that looking for the ideal. And I don't think the ideal is out there for anyone. And so that's where I think you get to decide, like, you know, is this important to you? My personal thought is you want to give it your all before you give up, and making sure, not in a bashing your head against the wall way, but being really thoughtful and understanding and learning and growing and doing a lot of these things we're talking about, and then you can much more clearly make a decision. And I think that was something I had mentioned, is that I also think that as you're working on it, if you are constantly deciding if it's worth it or not worth it, and this is not if it's abusive or dangerous, but that detracts from your ability to work on it. And so just decide you're gonna, you know, once a month make that decision, or once every 6 months, or once a year while you're working through things. And that makes the whole thing much more successful. I think when we're in a frustrated state and you're constantly flipping there, you're not showing up with love at all.
Yeah, I so agree with that. And I've said this a few times on the podcast. You know, when my ex and I separated, we didn't know we were a neurodiverse couple. And about a year and a half into our separation, we discovered that. And I wanted to stay married. And I was reading and I was sharing stuff with him. I know I was inundating him. And I really wanted to keep working on it. And that is one of the reasons why I stayed separated for 2.5 years and didn't file for divorce, because I really wanted to see if I had done everything that was under my control. I couldn't change him. I couldn't make him do anything, but everything that I thought I could do to be a better partner, because it was on me. I was not a great partner at times. And, then it got to the point where I knew this was not the right marriage or relationship for me. And, things change, and that's okay. But, I so agree with what you're saying, because if you're constantly on a daily basis measuring whether your partner is getting it right, whatever it is, you're gonna be dysregulated. You're not going to be, an emotionally safe place for them. You're not gonna be trusting each other. And so it does take time to like let that new relationship you're building, because you really are building a new relationship, grow. You cannot plant seeds today and expect to have a full, blossoming, blooming garden tomorrow. It's not going to work, right? Yeah. So I think one of the things that I see so many successful and happy and healthy neurodiverse couples doing is really understanding each other and appreciating each other's strengths and being respectful of each other's challenges. So do you want to share a little bit about, either how you do that work in coaching or how that looks in your own relationship?
And I think we talked a bit about it. It's appreciating that cup of coffee as a cup of love is probably the key thing, but really focusing on each other's strengths. And I, I've been working on this probably for 8 years and helping others. It's looking at what you're good at and what they're good at. My husband often, I shouldn't say gets upset with me, but he feels like, well, if 5% of people are like this and 95% of people are like this, why are the 95% right? And I was like, okay, you're right. We're not right. We're just in the majority. Because he's like, how come your way is the right way and my way is the wrong way? And so what I'm really think is really the answer is to look at what are they really good at and what are you really good at? And they may be really good. My husband's really good at fixing tech issues, and he's very non-emotional when my kids need help with contracts. And I mean, he is a lawyer, but aside from that, he has the, he's very logical about it. So car accidents, he's the man, like, whatever, things like that. And so when I started to think about that, rather than saying, well, he doesn't do this and he doesn't do that, what is he really good at? And in fact, I've now gotten even better at it, which is, what is he good at that I don't like doing? And how can I, because he does, and I think most husbands want to make you happy. As you said, they're bringing the Snickers bar, they want to make you happy and they don't know how. So figuring out those things that they are really good at and figuring out what you are really good at and realizing that you are just not going to be the same. One of the tenets of mindfulness, we talked about retraining your nervous system, but mindfulness also has these tenets, and one of them is generosity. And most of us want to be a generous person, but it's generosity of thinking and generosity of assuming good intent and generosity of looking at what they're really good at. And I think that when I think about it that way, it helps get you out of the sort of tug of war of the situation.
Yeah, I totally agree. And a lot of times I hear from neurodiverse couples, that wasn't my intent, but I know that that impacted my partner in a not so great way or a negative way. And, being generous and having curiosity when you do feel yourself getting dysregulated because of something your partner said or did or didn't say or didn't do, I think you can check in with yourself. And I've done it many times with the person who's currently in my life. It's not about him, it's about my nervous system and what I need to look in the mirror and check in on. And I think that that's really important. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to have conflict in our relationships. It doesn't mean that we're not going to get dysregulated. It's just, for me, it's been having a toolbox, of different things that I can do to be more mindful, to be more generous, to get more regulated and balanced quicker and smoother, right? So
Well,
are there
and
any?
yeah,
Go
I was
ahead.
just thinking that is exactly, a lot of people wonder what mindfulness is, and it is partly retraining your nervous system, but it's actually literally a toolbox for moving through the world, like more smoothly, as you mentioned,
Yeah.
smoothing the the bumps. And you actually mentioned a few others. So curiosity is another one. And I like thinking about in this mindfulness bucket, because then I'm like, well, I would like to show up mindful. And then I don't feel put upon doing it. That's the kind of person I'd like to be. And mm-hmm. so mindfulness is actually acceptance, right? You don't have to like it, by the way. You can just accept and not like it. It's showing up curious. It's showing up sort of non-striving, meaning that this relationship doesn't have to look like it's supposed to. There's compassion in there. There's patience in there. And there's a lot of pausing and noticing. And so I think sometimes thinking about it with a different framework can get you out of, again, the sort of tug of war and emotional dysregulation, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I think something you said that I think is critically important, and I'm going to repeat it, is acceptance.
Yes.
Acceptance doesn't mean you agree. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you even fully understand what your partner is saying or doing, but you accept that this is what is important to them. This is their reality. This is what is valid to them right now. And gosh, was that hard, Jesse, for me. I mean, you know.
Yeah. I think for me, though, what you said is critical about acceptance, which is acceptance doesn't mean condoning. It doesn't mean resignation. It's not giving up. It's not like understanding. It's literally, I always say accept and mm-hmm. that's what I do is, and has allowed me to accept things and not resist reality, which is I can accept and not like it. I can accept and allow it. I can accept and be angry. I can accept.
I like that.
So I get to pick the thing after the and. And I find for many, many people that that is really powerful, whether it's about your partner or whether it's about your job.
Right.
You know, anytime it's out of your control, you really do have to accept it, because resisting it is useless. It wastes a lot of energy and causes conflict, but you don't have to like it. And then I feel that I get that sense of empowerment that I just makes me feel better.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Yeah. And accepting it, I love what you said. You can accept it and still be angry,
Yeah. You
know, and then work through the anger. And that's another thing that I learned to, you know, look in the mirror and check myself, because I can accept what is and be angry, and I don't have to take it out on my partner. Mm-hmm. I just have to work. This is just me personally. I have to work through it, because oftentimes it is not theirs to take care of. It's mine, but that's just me, you know, and it's something that I was not aware of in my marriage. And I let, you know, my ex's no response get me dysregulated and get me angry, or his ignoring my texts or my calls because he was working and he couldn't transition. You know, so there were a lot of stories I was telling myself that weren't, you know, accurate and weren't true, but they caused me to react rather than respond in a kind or compassionate or a place of curiosity. So I love this conversation that we're having. I'm just wondering if there's anything else that you want to share about, you know, the mindfulness practice or helping to retrain your nervous system, any other things that came to you as we were chatting that you want to share with the listeners, or did we do a good job?
The only thing that comes to mind is that all of those things are a practice, and
right.
most of us have been practicing reacting for a long time, yeah. me in particular, because yes. it's a long, you know, long relationship. And so I think once we learn them, we're like, oh, I'm supposed to do this. And then we're mad at ourselves, and it causes a lot of frustration. And so I always say what you practice grows. So you start practicing these new things, and mm-hmm. what you don't practice recedes. But all of that takes time. And so many of us are, myself included, not the most patient people. And our culture doesn't really espouse patience these days. But if we can be patient, I think, with ourselves and with our partners. And I would say that was probably one of my biggest learnings is I always knew I wasn't patient. Doctors are not patient. We are trained to be urgent, but at least my partner is not at all urgent and moves on a totally different nervous system pace than I do. And so for me, learning that patience is really powerful. So I can practice patience, and I'm not going to get it right. And as a mom of kids, right, we have to practice patience.
Right.
So it's really beautiful learning. Also, I wanted to reflect on the anger that you mentioned, because I also think we have these tools and we think, okay, well, now I have them, I shouldn't be angry anymore. Or it's a neurodiversity problem and I shouldn't be angry about that. It's not their fault, but you are angry. Yeah. And it's okay to be angry is one of the things that it's okay to be disappointed. It's okay to be frustrated. These are all part of the human experience and they're actually part of loving relationships. Now, what you decide to do with them is another story. Mm-hmm. But right. I think for part of my own learning was really allowing myself to be angry. And you know, you can figure out what you do when you're angry and practice healthy anger. But I think it's really important to understand, I think our brain, especially in a romantic relationship, says you're not supposed to be angry. You're not supposed to be frustrated. You're not supposed to be disappointed. And then there's something wrong and you have to fix it. And then you end up down a not healthy rabbit hole. So yeah. It strikes me as a very important to allow yourself to be angry, allow your partner to be angry. Oh, and that's my biggest learning is when they tell you that they just like, they need a break or they need space. I have learned, it's taken tremendous practice to listen. You know, maybe that's not what I want, but if you play out how it always plays out, there are, you know, learnings over time where space and patience and is not necessarily a bad thing. I think for myself, leaving things unsettled and uncomfortable and frustrated, and I want it to be resolved and understand. And that's actually not possible sometimes in that moment, and accepting and not liking that it's not possible in that moment, and listening, because I think, interestingly, my husband told me he was telling me all this stuff for years and I just wasn't listening. And I'm guessing he probably was. I don't know what I was hearing. I have no idea, honestly. But I think this is the beautiful thing when you do the work on you. And it's not that I'm accommodating in any way. I think when we understand this, it's really, and this is probably, to be fair and honest, my own story much more than his. Right. It's he and I kind of against our neurodiversity. Like, so I make it a neurodiversity problem and mm-hmm. not a problem of him or me. It's like it's that. And when I put it there, I can accept and move on. And it's not personal. He actually does not like that framework, which is interesting, but I still keep it for myself because it works for me. And so again, I think you find the things that work for the overall good of the relationship, and that's the most healthy way to move forward. And again, not that, you know, these are all tools and nobody's going to get it right. And all relationships have conflict, but I do really think it's worth focusing on things that can work and might help. And rather than focusing on all the frustrations, because we know that doesn't help a whole lot.
No. And, you know, the Gottmans, Julie and John Gottman, who've been doing research, I think, for either over 50 years or close to 50 years with couples. And they don't talk about neurodiverse couples in particular, mm-hmm. but their research shows that 69% of the problems or challenges we have in relationships are not resolvable. They're perpetual problems, and only 31% are resolvable. And the first time I read that in one of their books, I was like, no way, that can't be right. So 69% of the problems and challenges I've been having in my marriage are never going to be resolvable. And it's true. And I wonder sometimes if in neurodiverse relationships, it might be even higher. And so just like we've been talking about throughout this episode, if we're always looking to change our partner and we're not willing to look in the mirror, then we're always going to be frustrated. We're going to suffer. I absolutely believe that. But, you know, if we look at the small percentage, whether it's 31% or less in our relationship of things that can be addressed together and can be solved, and not about changing our partner, but looking at the problem, not that our partner is the problem, but the problem and working together as a team to fix it, then I think we can move forward and hopefully be happy and healthy in our relationship. But I guarantee you, I was spending a lot more time on the 69% of the perpetual problems, and no Snickers bar was going to help.
Yeah. I've never heard that, and I love it. The other thing that feels important to bring up, because we've said so many times, is about changing yourself. And it's not that you, me are broken. It's just that that's what's in our control. And also, I think I used to think, well, why should I change if they're not going to change? And I think we change ourselves because it's better for us either way. It's better for you if your relationship is better, 1,000,000,000%. And if you change yourself and your relationship still isn't working for you, you'll be much better able to make a change and navigate it, you know, more easily and buoyantly. And so you win either way. And when I started to think about it that way, I'm more than happy now to change myself in almost every situation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. And so let me ask you this before we close out. And I do want you to give folks your contact information. But this one question just came to me as you were saying that. If you could talk to the couple that you were in your 20s, knowing what you know now, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would have wanted to tell either yourself or you and your husband in your 20s that might have helped? And, you know, there might not be anything that you would think to tell yourself. So I just thought I'd ask that. It came to me.
I think it's actually something that I practice now that I really wish I had known and it didn't come up today, which is that question, what would love do? And mm-hmm. I think it keeps you out of the weeds of all the complications. Yeah. And so for me, you know, I will often do hand to heart and ask myself, well, what would love do? And it's always love for you first, not actually love for the other person first, and then love for the other person, and then love for the relationship, and maybe love for your family. And I think that that doesn't steer you wrong almost ever. And then I think for me that I didn't have to understand, like I always tried to understand and that you don't have to have a great relationship. You don't have to understand. It doesn't have to make sense. So I think if I really had known those two things, it would have helped. And I would say probably what got us here though was just focusing on that love piece. And if that's where you perpetually go back to, it's like a life raft. We often say self-compassion is a life raft, but I would say the love in neurodiverse relationships is if you can get back to that core feeling, it helps you show up in a way that's softer and less reactive.
Yeah, that's really good. And I've said this on the podcast once or twice before. I know that I could always respond in a positive way if I asked that question when there were issues with my daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, what would love do? I never had a problem doing that with her, no matter how, mm-hmm. you know, challenging she was. And she was a really good kid, but, you know, we all have our challenges.
Yes, of course.
Right. But, you know, I so often couldn't get there with my ex-husband, and it didn't mean that I didn't love him, because gosh, did I love him, and I was in love with him for most of our marriage. But I think that's really something valuable for the listeners to think about. And maybe love would say, this isn't the right relationship for me mm-hmm. anymore. And that's okay. But looking at the challenges or how you're going to respond rather than react through that lens of love, I think could make a difference for a lot of folks. Yeah, I really like that. Thank you. Anything else? Yeah, anything else before we have you share your contact information?
Yeah, I feel like it's been a fantastic conversation and complete.
Awesome. For today. Me too.
We are always learning and always growing.
Right. And so I'd love it, Jesse, if you could give the listeners your contact information, the best way for them to get information about your workshops and who you work with. That would be fantastic.
Yeah. So the best way to reach me is just my website, and you can find me there, which is my name. So it's jessiemahoneymd.com, and Jesse is Jessie. My business is also called Pause and Presence. And so if you type in pauseandpresence.com, you also end up there. And if you want to email me, it's jessie@jessiemahoneymd.com. So it's pretty easy to find. And The other thought that came to mind is on that website, you know, I actually write a lot about this topic. And so that's one of the ways I think I work through and learn things is writing a blog. So I've been writing a blog on this and other sort of, I always say they're like musings on life and love. And so if anyone's interested in that, you can read it there or sign up and it emails you whenever I write something new. I do write a lot. It's part of my way of moving through the world, as it turns out. But the people that I work with are mostly physicians, but you don't have to be a physician. I also work with a lot of people in healthcare. And then I think the other group of people that I work with are, I call them high achieving, and I will say mostly women, but not always. High achieving, meaning they're, you know, lawyers or execs, or because you're thinking in that same thought pattern of having to fix, manage, and control and push and not rest, and that we have very high expectations. And until we do this work and start to figure out, well, who do I want to be, and what are my priorities, and how do I want to show up in the world? And so that's the group of people that I work with. I also will say I do, as a former pediatrician, I do a lot of sort of parent coaching as well, because if your parenting relationship is a challenge, co-parenting, there's issues with children. People who are in neurodiverse marriages often have neurodiverse children.
Right.
It's just the way it is. And so I actually tend to coach on everything. What I have found is that people will come to me for career coaching, but turns out they're in a neurodiverse relationship. So this does tend to be a thread that comes through everything that I do. And I will say that sometimes people, it's hard to come directly about your relationship, or maybe you're not ready yet, but that the tools of getting coaching and learning mindfulness can help you with everything else that you do. A lot of people are willing to get coaching as a parent. That feels more comfortable. And yet a lot of the same tools help you in your marriage. And so I think meeting people where they are is the most powerful. And then I have a couple other ways that people can learn about things. I have a podcast myself called the mindfulhealerspodcast.com. And it's not all on relationships, but a lot of episodes are. And there are episodes on, I have a series called Parent with Presence and a series called Mindful Love. So they pop up at different times. And then I also teach yoga, and anybody is welcome to do my yoga and work on retraining your nervous system. And I teach yoga for free because I like it and it keeps me retraining my own nervous system. So you can find the links there, to join me. I teach a live stream class, and then I have a YouTube channel, which is Mindful Yoga for Healers with my name. But you do not have to be a healer, and anyone can partake of the classes. And I just do that. It began as a passion project at the beginning of COVID to help my fellow doctors, and it's turned into a YouTube channel.
So, that's phenomenal.
I love it. And we all need a little nervous system retraining, myself included. So if anyone wants to join me for that, you are all more than welcome. The more the merrier. I'm teaching the classes anyway.
Fantastic. And I'll put all of that in the show notes.
Thank you.
And absolutely. And thank you. Thank you for sharing how you have grown and you have learned in your relationship and in your career and how you're helping others. I always think it's fantastic when I can share positive things with the listeners, because, you know, it's really easy to focus on the differences and how they become challenges, but it's a little bit more difficult. And sometimes it takes a lot more time and energy and presence to focus on how to move from that maybe dysregulated place in your own life and your relationship to a place of balance and peace and joy, which we all deserve, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So thank you again for sharing your time with me and your expertise and your lived experience. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.